tassa bhagavato arahato samma samputassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma samputassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma samputassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang nissami. Thank you for inviting me. Very good to see you. So many good friends and so much support. And you're an Ajahn too. You have to call him Ajahn now. Almost next year, we can start now. Ajahn Jagannando. Why not start early? So I'm very inspired to see such devotion and interest in the presence of forest monks here. Just historically, maybe I'll just reflect a bit on telephones and things. Modern life. I was in Thailand with Joseph. He was a Bhagaro Bhikkhu then. And we were young and very intense, dedicated to the practice. And Lompa Cha had a... I think he was fascinated by us because we were so eccentric and so intense, and we all fought too much. And I think he was very interested in us in a crazy way. But in the end, he said, well, you Westerners are really just the same. You just got bigger noses. Jamu Piao. So Lopa Cha had a sense of he wasn't... He was more than just a Thai monk. He was very cosmopolitan. He was a very human monk, I think, in the sense that he could really look at a human being and take time to listen to them and have some sense and deep sense of understanding, and then offer guidance from that deep sense of compassion and wisdom that he had. And of the many things that inspired me about him was his capacity both to be serenely peaceful when you sat with Lompa Cha and he wasn't engaging in the worldly dharmas, and just sitting under his kuti and being very, very silent. There was this powerful, compassionate, silent presence just being with him. So that was most impressive at a silent level. But also his capacity to do worldly things, organize a monastery, deal with various kinds of people, various problems. He was very, very skillful. So he had these two sides, very skillful in worldly dharmas and very skillful in his own practice, obviously very attained. And I was struck by that because he wasn't just an ascetic that lived on his own and couldn't handle things. Very, very, very skillful. And just as one example, I often tell this example, but we were this, I don't know if you were there, but it was a very interesting one where, and I hope I have the story right, you can tell me what's wrong, but Lompa Cha would sit under his kuti. You know, in Thailand, the monks' cabins are on stilts, so Lompa would sit underneath, and we would gather underneath and just listen to him, and other people would come, maybe villagers would come with their problems. Sometimes there'd be no one there. You sit silently. Sometimes the monks come or the nuns would come. So it was a kind of, like in India, they say satsang. You'd sit with Lompa and just be there and listen to the way he dealt with things. And there was a lot of Dhamma in that. And beside the wicker bench that Lompa sat on, there was if I remember, a large ledger book where people, if they wanted to make donations, they could put money in this ledger book, and they could sign their names, and then the accountant at the end of the day from the village would come, collect the funds, and bank it for the monastery, because the monks can't handle money. Well, one day the main bell rang in a time when there was no scheduled meeting. There were no pujas or anything, so we all went to Lompa Cha's kuti, and he announced that someone had stolen 1,000 baht. Come on. Someone had stolen 1,000 baht. So I thought, uh-oh, now we're going to get a talk on adinadana. No, you shouldn't steal. But actually, he was very skillful, because what he wanted to do was to save whoever stole that money, if the person was among us. He wanted to somehow rectify their bad karma. So he said to us, all of you, and I think we were maybe 40 monks, novices, and so on, in the monastery at Wat Pho Phong. And he said, make a package which would look like 1,000 baht in notes of tens or fives, or I forget what notes, and make a package about so big with leaves or with paper, go back to your kuti, make the package, and then bring the package to a central point, which was the main bell tower. And 3 senior monks were there to receive these packages. So we all did that. We went to our kutis, and we made these packages. And so if someone had stolen the 1,000 baht and was in the monastery, they had a chance now to change that kamma to good kamma, better kamma. So we all went, and we did that, and the 3 senior monks received all these packages, and all 3 were watching, and they opened up all the packages. Well, it turned out the money didn't show up, so we thought, well, someone from outside the monastery had stolen the money. But what was, to me, really skillful is that here was a human problem, a normal human problem, and how well and how originally he handled that. It was really, really creative, really, really wise thing to do. And that to me was like a perfected human being who doesn't live an abstract kind of meditative life where you know, he was okay sitting on a zafu, as it were, but then in ordinary life he couldn't function. But exactly the opposite. He dealt with these worldly dhammas in a really brilliant and inspiring way. Now, we have the occasion now where the group here who've been dreaming and inviting the monks to start a forest monastery, and that's been, I think the group started 15 years ago, and many of you have practiced meditation for many, many years. And for the Thai people, of course, it's in your blood. You know, it's part of the beauty of your culture to have monks and to have forest monks and so on. So this has come together through a lot of goodness. It takes a lot of very, very good energy to get a monastery going. You have to have a great ajahn. This is he's a wonderful monk. You're very, 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 don't blush. You're very fortunate, actually, and he's willing to do it, because it's a lot of work. It's good work. It's very, very good work. There has to be just a lot of understanding of what Sangha is, what meditation is, what a tradition is. And we are part of a very orthodox tradition, orthodoxy in a good sense, in that one of the things I'm really grateful for, having lived in Thailand, I lived in Thailand 5 years, I ordained in 73, and then I had a chance to live in Thailand, and then Lompa Cha asked me to go to England, which I really didn't want, but it was, fortunately, I was with Ajahn Sumedho, so that was nice. But I hadn't, you know, when I went to Thailand, I hadn't even meditated. I didn't even know retreats existed. I just had this impulse to go and ordain in Thailand. But what I learned in Thailand was a whole cultural, ritualized way of doing rites of passage, of coming together, of contemplation, of celebration, of memorial, all kinds of really good things, which I was confirmed in the Lutheran church, but as I tell people, my parents, we went to church every other year. So we didn't, you know, we weren't religious that way. But then being in Thailand and seeing how for Vesak, you know, everyone comes together and they celebrate the life of the Buddha, or someone dies, there's a way of doing reflections and contemplations, like, say, two years ago now. I was in Thailand 2 years ago, and we had a Canadian monk who was living in Thailand, and he was going to come and return to Canada and be with us in Tisara, in a monastery. And 2 weeks before he was to, and I saw him, and I came back first, 2 weeks before he was to fly back to Canada, he had an aneurysm, and they found him dead in front of his cave, his head bleeding. Shocking. But why I mention that is not to make you depressed, but actually that what happened afterwards, how the community handled the death of a monk, and what they brought the monk's body to Wat Nanachat, and there were 100 bhikkhus there, including Lompo Liam and Lompo Sumedho and many senior monks, and they cremated the body, open cremation, and did funeral chanting, reflections, Dhamma talks, contemplation throughout the night around the body. And that, as a Westerner living in Toronto, I had no idea. What do you do with that? What do you do when someone dies? You just fumble around, kind of. And here was a culture, Thai culture, Buddhist culture, going on for a long time, that had a very, very beautiful and significant way of dealing with something so profound as death, anyone's death. So these rituals that, like we do the five precepts and ritual chanting, you can see if you were raised with that, if you were like a Thai person or a Lao person or a Sri Lankan person, a Cambodian, and you were raised as a child from that, every time you did that chanting, every time you do that chanting, it reminds you of the goodness. You know, plugs you into goodness because it's related to goodness. And this is the power of ritual. This is the power of ritual, which is not superstitious. It needn't be superstitious, but it's rather emotive. It's emotive in a good way. Just as I can remember something good and have a good memory and a good intention from that, or I can remember bad things, ritualized ceremonies are very meaningful if we make them meaningful. And so that's something new for many people. But don't be shy. I mean, if you don't like it, that's okay too. But realize that when you invite, say, a forest tradition from an Orthodox tradition, you have this really rich possibility then of opening up Buddhism to something bigger than mindfulness and stress reduction. You know, it is much, much bigger than that. That's a very good thing, but there's much, much more to it, much, much more to it than that. And that becomes apparent as the life of the monastery evolves. You begin to, you know, have your own situation when something comes up and you can ask, so can we do something? Can we celebrate that? Or can we mourn? Or can we have a memorial service or something? And so there's a richness in the cycle of a year and the cycle of a life that becomes apparent as you live. So it's more than just a bunch of guys meditating and you joining in their meditation. It's a very, very rich thing that we're involved in. So I'm grateful that I had a chance to train in Thailand because I had a chance to see a vibrant culture with a vibrant teacher where certainly there were superstitious elements in these things, but because Lompo Cha interpreted them so wisely, they gave a life to many things which I would fumble around with. I remember once I lived in Wellington for 10 years, and there was a man, neighbor, good friend, but he wasn't into Buddhism, and he died of a heart attack, and I was invited to the funeral, and the family had no way of conducting the funeral, and they were so lost, and it was a kind of lost opportunity. And then I compared to the ways that we have these things and bring meaning into them. I did, about a month ago, a couple, a Sri Lankan couple came, and they're going to get married. And as monks, we're not allowed to do marriage ceremonies, but we have blessings. And they came to the monastery, and they offered food, and they took the five precepts, and we had a chance to chant the blessing chants and offer for reflections on how to use marriage as a spiritual vehicle. How can you use this as two beings growing in Dhamma, growing in wisdom, and growing in generosity and compassion? And that was lovely, lovely to offer. So there's that kind of richness that when you take a tradition that comes to us from 2,500 years. I was joking yesterday, it was 2,500 years of potlucks. Yeah, you have to be Canadian to understand that, but. The heart, the real heart of the forest monastery is the integrity of each individual. You know, whether it's a person on a lay committee or whether it's the monastic community, the integrity of the practice. And we so often talk about the practice that sometimes people don't know what we're talking about. What do we mean by the practice? Well, I would look at the practice as twofold. One is the worldly dharmas that we have, and one is the inner world that we work with. So in terms of worldly dharmas now, to start a monastery takes a lot of worldly work. One has to organize funds, one has to figure out committees and transport and building and all the rest. It's a very, very complicated thing to do. And so we have responsibilities within that. Some, there'll be a treasurer, and there'll be a president, and there'll be people in charge of donor rosters. And these are what we call the worldly dharmas. It's just like in the kitchen. In the kitchen, you have the cook and the waiter and the person that buys the food and the manager and the person at the till and all that. These are worldly dharmas. And these have to be done well. And these have to be done well. So there's a kind of imperative to be responsible. That's why we talk about the five precepts. We talk about being responsible with the duties that we are given, to do them well, to do them thoroughly. And those worldly dharmas, sometimes the word worldly sounds a bit like it's not important, but it is important. It is important to make sure that the cash register is balanced at the end of the day. Make sure that the shrimp is well cooked, right? Make sure that the curries aren't too hot, or we're going to burn. Make sure that the rice is cooked. Make sure that the people on the tables are well served, and so on. You have to do it right, don't you? Same with the monastery. The legal things that you'll face to make sure that it's in line with planning applications, that, charitable status, emails, all of that. So to have excellence in that is good. It's very, very important. But if that's all we did, if that's the only thing we did, we only did the worldly things well, then all we'd be is efficient. But that's not enough. But it's necessary. It's not enough, but it's necessary. And the other part is when we observe our inner world. So as you're, whether you're cooking food or you're at a committee meeting, we always have an inner world. We have the world of our thoughts and our emotions and our reactions and our memories and our tiredness and our liking and our disliking and our fears and hopes and all of that. And this inner world, if we don't pay attention to that, then the inner world is not trained, it's not wise, it's reactive, and that spoils the outer world, doesn't it? So if I'm a person that's always very demanding or very controlling or very arrogant or very domineering or very angry, very fearful, and I'm not aware of that, and I don't take responsibility for that, then that goes outward. I create the world around me through these misunderstood inner feelings. If I hate myself, I shouldn't be angry, I should just love everyone all the time, I shouldn't be fearful, then I also, that's not Dhamma, that's not really understanding. So the inner work that we do, we're doing all the time. We're doing all the time. And the inner work requires an awakened mind. We need to be aware. Mindfulness and stress reduction. We need to awaken to our inner world. And this we can do. This we can do. We can constantly do that. And we have to constantly do that. Say, well, what do you feel like right now? I don't want this or I don't want that. I like you. I don't like you. I'm afraid of you. I'm in love with you. I hate you. These different movements of the heart and mind. When Joseph and I were young, and he had no hair, in Thailand, we always tell these interesting food stories, because one of the things as a Western monk in Thailand when I got there was that I had been traveling for 3 years through Europe, through Asia, and I finally got myself into a monastery. And while I was traveling, or while I was a student, I could do what I wanted to, basically. When I wanted to eat, I could eat. If I want to go to the movie, go to the movie. And other things I won't describe. So there was basically this chance to distract the mind or whatever I wanted. So then I got into the monastery, and all of a sudden there's no music. Celibacy. Oftentimes in the first 2 years there was no one who could speak English. There were no books. There was no yogurt. There was just basically plodak and sticky rice. Just very, very basic food. Huh? and bitterleaves and very basic food. And all of a sudden, I started to have food issues. I never had food issues. Well, because my greed could go into music or into travel or whatever it wanted. And now, all my greed was focused on a bigger mango or a bigger banana or more sugar or very simple things. And I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed at how greedy my mind was. I thought, oh, how come? Well, it was because all the avenues of escape now were locked into one thing. They're locked into the food. And actually, it was very difficult. Not the food. It was giving up. Giving up what I wanted and not getting what I wanted and having what I don't want. It was very, very difficult. Oftentimes, I'd feel terribly lonely. And the Thai people are just so generous and so good to us. It's, you know, I have eternal gratitude to the Thai people for all the kindness I've been shown and continue to show. But still, I'd feel lonely, right? Because I was a Farang. You know, I remember sometimes, one particular time, it's strong in my memory, where Lompo Cha would be giving a long, long desana. You know, and he could give long desanas. I could never do that. No, you know, he's probably on for an hour, maybe an hour and a half, just, you know, why do you suffer? Because you won't be quiet. And my Thai was not very strong. And then I remember, you know, I'd lost track and I didn't know, and I was just feeling restless, and I just want to go back to my kuti. We had no cushions, concrete floor. And then Lompo Cha cracked a joke, a really good joke. Everyone laughed except me, because I didn't understand. And I felt so lonely. I felt, oh, I want to know. So lonely. And that's quite painful. But what was Lompo Cha saying? He says, Ploy Wong. And what does Ploy Wong mean? Let go. And what does letting go of loneliness mean? Well, I couldn't get rid of it. I could have jumped the fence and gone back to Canada. But I had, you know, I love this tradition. I love Lompo Cha. I said, so it challenged me. He said, well, just let go. And I thought letting go meant that I would never feel sad or sorrow. But there I was. I was feeling very, very lonely. Very lonely. Feeling sorry for myself and so on. And then Lompo Cha said, why wrong? And I contemplated, what does he mean by letting go? And then slowly, and it didn't happen that time. It took a long time. It began to seem, let it be. Just let it, just loneliness. Don't make it a problem. It just feels like this. It's just lonely. And I began to see that not only there's the movement of the mind, but behind that there's the stillness. There's the stillness of awareness. There's the stillness of knowing. And as I began to see that, I could make a choice. The feeling of the loneliness, I couldn't feel it. I couldn't make a choice there. It just came up. Because culturally, I was in a different culture, even though people were very kind. But I could begin to make a choice and not follow the loneliness, not think lonely thoughts, not blame anyone, and just be very patient with loneliness. And I'd go to Lompo Cha and I'd say, oh, Lompo, my practice is no good, I'm hopeless. And he'd say, well, you never meditated. Wat Thon. And Wat Thon means endure. And he was right. I had never trained the mind. I had just done what I wanted to do. I thought he'd give me a really good desana and figure it all out for me and I wouldn't have to suffer. He said, no, you have to endure. And so I began to endure. I began to endure heat and mosquitoes and not having what I wanted. But that was very powerful, very, very powerful. And I'm grateful actually for the simplicity, because Isan then was very poor. Like if we saw a car in the parking lot, it was like, wow, a car. it was a big deal to sell a car. And so it was so away from my culture. And there were no distractions. I only had my own heart, my own mind. What to do? I had to figure out how to meditate. I had to figure out how to come to terms with loneliness and fear. And I began, through Lompo Cha's instruction, Lompo Samedo instruction, I began to get a feeling for what awareness is. And awareness is very interesting, because awareness, if you're feeling lonely, right? Awareness is not lonely. Awareness knows loneliness, right? If you're feeling anger, awareness knows anger. If you're feeling happy, awareness knows happy, right? So awareness is always bigger, say. It's always bigger. Happiness, sadness, sorrow, these things come and go. They come and go. And non-attachment, or ploy wong, or non-grasping, is beginning to take refuge in this clarity of awareness. Even if you feel bad, even if you feel lonely, especially if you feel lonely, actually, especially if you feel bad. Because what I found is if I could just be with loneliness and just be patient, or ton, bear with it, not make a problem out of it, then eventually the loneliness began to go away. It began to cease. It began to just fall away. And my heart began to have much more peace than when I was distracted. When I was a layman, if I felt lonely, then I'd drink some alcohol or listen to the music or do something. I would distract. I would try to get away from the loneliness. Now I'm in the monastery. I feel lonely. I feel sad. Nowhere to go. No distraction. No compensation. What to do? Be aware. Be patient. Watch. Witness. Watching, witnessing, being said, loneliness is not permanent. It's not who I am. It's just a condition. It's painful. I don't like it, but it'll go. If I'm patient, it's gone. Where did it go? And I begin to see, well, what didn't go, what was always there, is awareness. And this begins to, like a magic for me. Of course, awareness is always here. But sadness isn't always here. Fear isn't always here. Joy isn't always here. Nice food isn't always here. Right? And you begin to see, that's what we mean by Bhutang Saranang Gacchami. That's what we mean by refuge in Buddha. Not this chap sitting next to me. But what that points to. And that points to my own possibility to be awake and to know, fear is this way, loneliness is this way. And as we do that, and we make that, we have faith in that. And when we talk about saddha, or faith, it's this deep sense of that is our real home. Lompa Cha often used that phrase, our real home. And what is our real home? It's not Boston. Is it? Okay. It's not Boston. Our real home is here. It has to be here. Right? It has to be. That's the only place it can be. So we all have that. You know, so we're all the same. Just Furungs have longer noses. And, you know, you're a Thai or a Bostonian or an Ottawonians or Canadians. Whatever, that doesn't matter. Those are nationalities, aren't they? Male, female, doesn't matter. Old, young, doesn't matter. Good cook, bad cook, maybe that matters. I don't know. Probably matters if you're going to get a raise. but seriously, you know, this possibility, human possibility of liberation. And so I could see that for me, I just had to realize that my conditioning has a certain amount of fear in it. A certain amount of anger, a certain amount of compassion. But what I could do, I could emphasize the wholesome. I could emphasize dana. I could emphasize sila. I could make strong gratitude. Katanyu katavedi. I could make those stronger in my mind by thinking in that way. So I bring Lompa Cha up, or Ajahn Sumedho up into my meditation practice. I have a picture of Lompa Cha and Lopo Sumedho, and I have a picture of my mother, and I have all kinds of pictures of people I like. And I remember, and I say, thank you. I bring up gratitude. So we can develop the wholesome. We can make the wholesome stronger. Huh? And we can let go of the unwholesome. We cannot reinforce the unwholesome. So greed, hatred, and delusion. That starts to give a power to consciousness which has a foundation of stillness and quietness. The more we function from compassion, the more we function from generosity, morality, being responsible, the more our hearts are peaceful and still. And the more we let go and not indulge in greed, hatred, and delusion, the more our hearts become still. So we create this kind of foundation for entering more and more deeply into the silence of the mind, more and more deeply into what the Buddha was pointing to. And this is the work in the kitchen, or in the office, or in the home. So whether, you know, you're cooking in a restaurant, or you're on a committee for the new monastery, it's the same work. Cooking is different. Being the treasurer is different. But in the inner work is the same, because we're all the same. You know, we all get angry, we get fearful, we get fed up with work, we don't like the flu, and we like vacations. So we're all the same. We're all the same that way. There's nothing different, right? And so the work we do inwardly is very good work, very, very important work. when Lopo Semedo was when we were heading out to England, Lopo Semedo asked Lopo Cha, "So, what am I supposed to do there?" You know, we're kind of going off to England, whatever that was. And Lompo Cha said, "Oh, make a good soup. And they'll make a good soup and they'll come and they'll eat." You know, so that's what we're doing kind of in our own hearts, being good people. We're making good soup or good curries or whatever you want, right? And so that is very beautiful in a human being. If you think about what is human beauty? It's not necessarily physical, is it? Sure, certainly we can appreciate beauty on that kind of physical level, but when a human being is deeply compassionate and deeply wise, there's this tremendous beauty. And I think Joseph and I found that Lompa Cha was beautiful. He was short. He was, what, 5'1"? He's maybe 5 foot tall. And you know, he's nice size. And whenever we saw him, we just dropped to our knees. We just wanted to be on our knees. And he was so graceful. He was never in a hurry. He always I was very regal. He'd walk never in a hurry, just walking along. And yet there was this great power in him. And so with Lompo Cha, I saw the possibility of beauty. When the human mind is developed, and when we work on the Dhamma and we develop ourselves, the possibility for humanity is very beautiful. And then you think about someone like Lompo Cha or Lompo Semedo, how many years they served culture, how much they gave. And now, the echo of Lompo Cha, now we have a monastery in Boston, from that kind of goodness and power that Lompo Cha gave us and other teachers through the ages. So I'm very grateful, again, that and inspired that I've been able to be with you today. And I certainly wish you the very best in this endeavor. Make sure he comes back, right? Ajahn Janto will be coming in the summer. So in the meantime, what's the very best thing you can do is really keep your practice going. Keep the Dhamma practice going in your heart, and that will serve the community very, very well. And if there's anything we up in Canada can do for you, we can maybe send you some maple syrup or something, or some beavers. Please do let us know how we can help. So I wish you all the best.